to the rest of the chapter. This will be an attitude that you may experience from fundamentalists. There's a difference between fundamentalists and Bible believers. And I don't know, a year or so ago I preached a message, the differences between a fundamentalist and Bible believers. And I used to get upset when I'd hear the news media refer to the Muslims as fundamentalists. That used to bother me, but now I kind of get a chuckle out of it because they are fundamentalists. And basically there are two types of religions in the world, and that's a Bible believer and the rest are fundamentalists. Now the fundamentalists have different types of fundamentalists, where they have a basic core set of beliefs. Catholic fundamentalists, Baptist fundamentalists, charismatic fundamentalists, evangelicals, where if you go there for about 6 months to a year, you basically have heard, within 6 months of you've heard all they can give you. And everything else after that just be a repeat of the fundamentals. The fundamentals that they choose. Okay, charismatic, so forth, so on. Okay, a Bible believer is somebody who takes all the words of the Bible. And a Bible believer, a true blue Bible believer, I would say is difficult to label. What's he going to preach on this Sunday? Well, who really knows? And that's what I believe a Bible believer is like. Okay, and so those are the two different things. A Bible believer is usually the greatest opponent or enemy of a Bible believer is another fundamentalist. That'll be the ones that'll be pestering you more than anything. And it's the same crowd that crucified Jesus Christ. Who? Conservative fundamentalists. They were called Pharisees. That's who crucified Jesus Christ. And of course, today what they're crucifying is the King James Bible. They have a common enemy. And you'll find some of these religious fundamentalists, conservatives, you'll find that they'll team up with a liberal because they have a common enemy. Perfect case in point is Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University is considered to be a conservative fundamental university, yet they honor and they uphold the Westcott and Hort Greek manuscripts. And in Westcott and Hort were Catholics, Mariolaters. One of them liked to smoke dope, one of them liked to drink beer. And they believed in Mariolatry, and both of them despised America, and they believed in socialism. Yet, for some strange reason, they think that's the greatest Greek text. Very weird. Well, that's because they have a common enemy. The enemy is the King James Bible, the final authority. Okay, so Jeremiah 26, verse 8, it says, "Now it came to pass when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking all, that the Lord had commanded him to speak unto all the people, that the priests and the prophets and all the people took him, saying, Thou shalt surely die." Real open-minded, aren't they? Now, let's kill Jeremiah. And notice the priests, prophets, and the people. Now, who do you think was instigating that? The priests and the prophets. They were getting the people to say, "Thou shalt surely die." And he says, "Why hast thou prophesied in the name of the Lord, saying, This house shall be like Shiloh, and this city shall be desolate without an inhabitant?" All the people were gathered against Jeremiah in the house of the Lord. All mad at him. Every one of them mad at him. And he's just giving out the truth. Okay, and so that's what a Bible believer will face. Your biggest opponents will be religious conservatives, fundamentalists. It's funny, I was talking to Kerry Sleeman. He's one of the men that runs the softball leagues down there, all the baseball and softball leagues. I was able to win him to the Lord about 3 years ago, maybe three or four, I can't remember what. And he's got real good insight with people, and he's really understands people. And one time, he said just recently, he was talking to a lady at the ballpark, and she was really spilling her guts to him. And the idea, she asked him a question. She said, "Do you go to church?" He said, "Yeah. Not too often, but," he says, "when I do go, I go." And she said, "Where do you go?" And he told her. She said, "Oh, he's a nut." He referred to me. I didn't know what kind she meant, pecan or walnut or cashew. I didn't know what kind. And he just kind of said, "Well, why would you say that? Have you ever talked to him? Have you ever heard him preach?" "No." Then she said, "Well, I probably shouldn't say that." Well, she'd get under conviction now because he'd asked her a couple questions. And so then she, in the conversation, she said something about being closed-minded, and then he kind of said, "Well, aren't you a little closed-minded?" And she said, "Well, I guess you got a point there." And that's how to handle people. It's a good way to handle them. And you'll find the same thing about people about Ruckman. Ask him, "Did you ever read anything he wrote? You ever listen to him?" "No." "Oh, real broad-minded. Real broad-minded." Now, it's also, you find this in the political world. You know, and you know, I'm glad Rush Limbaugh is on the radio. He's not as conservative as I think he should be. You know, I'm further right than he is, way over there. But even at that, I'm sure glad somebody's picking on the liberals. See? And you, some of these extreme liberals, they hate Limbaugh, and they won't, and they never listen to him. See? And so the thing is, you face all these things in every field. Okay, so here we go. We've got all these people against Jeremiah, verse 10. "When the princes of Judah heard these things, then they came up from the king's house unto the house of the Lord." So now we got, here we go, the ATF's coming in. Gonna fix the situation. You know, we got an uproar. The people and the prophets are mad. They're gonna kill Jeremiah, the people, and the police in the area. Here they come. They're gonna come rescue somebody. I don't know. "The princes of Judah heard these things when they came up from the king's house unto the house of the Lord and sat down in the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house. Then spake the priests and the prophets unto the princes and to all the people, saying, This man is worthy to die, for he hath prophesied against this city as ye have heard him with your ears." He's too negative. So just speaking against somebody makes you worthy of death? Now here we have what's called the thought police. You know, you can't say anything to anybody. The thought police here. How, that's what we have a great thing in our country, freedom of speech, but you really don't have freedom of speech. If you buy a radio broadcast and pay for the 30-minute broadcast, you can't really say what you want to say freely. If I own a radio station, anybody can say anything they want on mine. Outside of vulgarity, but even at that.
We heard on the radio the other night that it was a conservative political talk show, and the guy actually said that he thinks that it's right for a person that says that they wanted to, something about discrimination that had to do with terrorism,
Oh, okay.
If they speak out against the United States, they should expect to die. That's what he said. And he was talking about the Middle East, you know, airbag company.
Right, right.
You know, promoting terrorism and stuff like that. But I mean, if you say something, you should expect to die. And I think that's crazy.
Yeah, that's where they're heading, they're thought police. Okay, and now, obviously, there's ways you can handle things, like in a court, you cannot say to the judge, "You are a low-down scoundrel." That's contempt of court. But you can say, "Judge, I believe you're a low-down scoundrel." Now, that's different. Okay, and the idea is, who can control our thoughts? Well, that's what they're trying to do. It's like a little boy was told to sit down by his mom, and he didn't want to sit down, but she made him sit down. And he says, In my mind, I'm still standing. Okay. It's a matter of your thought. You're really saying the same thing, except you're putting I believe in front of that. I think that. You can't control what I think. The other one is an accusation. It's a direct accusation. Right. Right. Thank you for that. Okay. Let's see. That's verse 11. Now they're wanting to kill him. Okay. Now you'll find the same thing in the New Testament, Acts 22. The first 21 verses, Paul is giving his testimony in Acts 22, and he's speaking in Hebrew. It's recorded in Greek, which is an inspired translation. And the Hebrew people are listening to him as he's speaking in Hebrew. And in Acts 22, verse 22, he says a magical word. And when, as soon as he says this magical word, they go in a fit of rage, and they said he's worthy of death for saying one word. Now, I wonder if we have that trouble in America. One special word. The word that he happened to say was Gentiles. Acts 22, verse 22. Now, in Luke chapter 4, the Lord Jesus was in the same situation where it says in Luke 4, verse 23, that the people marveled at his gracious words. Luke 4:23, and by the time you get to Luke 4:30, they wanted to kill him and throw him over a cliff. There's something that he said within seven verses, that made them so mad that they wanted to kill him. And he didn't say the word Gentiles. He implied it. He gave two illustrations that were references to Gentiles, and the Jews were so hypersensitive that as soon as he made that reference, they wanted to kill him. Now, that is an example of people who love themselves. Hypersensitive. Americans are getting that same way. Okay, you can go on a college campus, any Christian college, and you say the word Bruckman, and all of a sudden you'll see them, you know, break out in hives and just go crazy. If you go on the halls of Congress back in the 50s, and if you would have said, now the guy's slipped my mind. What's his name? Who? McCarthy. Yeah, you say that. Also, they'd have gone nuts. Okay, you can say any, virtually any slang about any race except one race. The dreaded N-word. Okay. I mean, the blacks can call you honky, and Jesse Jackson can refer to New York as Heimetown. Okay, but you can't reverse the thing and call them what they am. And that's the way to think of. Of course, we have a famous man in America, Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know the translation of that name? Very interesting translation. Schwarzenegger. Get it? Schwarzenegger. It means black nigger. That's what his name means, translated from German to English. Well, that's a fact. Okay, and so why can't a black man who owns the Africa House, when a white man walks in, he walks up to the white man and says, "Get out of here. We don't want your kind here." And there's no newspaper articles, no nothing about that. Or a white woman who gets on a telephone in a private conversation and just says, "We don't want them here," referring to a different race, and she gets sued and has to pay over $100,000. Now, why is that? Now, to be honest with you, I am for the black man who owns the Africa House. If he doesn't want Whitey to come in, that's his right. If he owns a property and he doesn't want, if he wants to serve, if he only wants left-handed blacks as his customers, that is his right. And I will stand up for that right. Okay, but yet anybody should have that right in this country. Okay, so the biggest, if you want to study as far as discrimination goes and prejudice and all that stuff, the biggest pushers or the greatest causers of discrimination and hatred between the races is two sources, and that's government policies and the national news media. They are the biggest causes of it, the national news media. Okay, so here in Jeremiah 26, verse 11, he has said something that they say we want to kill him. Hypersensitive people. Verse 12, then spake Jeremiah to all the princes and to all the people, saying, the Lord sent me to prophesy against this house and against this city all the words that ye have heard. So the idea is, what you getting mad at me for? I didn't say it. I just quoted what he said. Therefore now amend your ways and your doings. Notice he didn't back off. I like that. He didn't back off from. You see, people try to say things about you to intimidate you. One of the biggest fears that people are afraid of being labeled as a racist or prejudiced. The biggest fear. It is nothing but intimidation. Anybody, when they get into discussion, anybody who brings up the issue of race, the reason why they bring that up is because they have no further arguments. They have run out of all arguments. Just think when they bring that up first. I mean, they had no argument from the start. Several years ago, I used to write letters to the paper. I don't think they print them anymore. But back then, they used to print them about Martin Luther King. About the Sunday before, I'd usually write something in the newspapers about him being a communist and all this stuff. So we had a Mexican girl and a black guy came and interviewed me from St. Joe College. It was on a Wednesday night after church. And the first question the Mexican girl asked was, are you prejudiced? I said, what's it mean? She said, fear and ignorance. I looked at her and said, fear and ignorance? Prejudice? I said, look at the word. Cut it in half. Prejudging. That's what it means. She said, no, it means fear and ignorance. And after that whole interview, Janet and I, we had some great ideas. We wish we would have fulfilled them, but we didn't do it. She thought that I was some, you know, male chauvinist pig, you know, that I would thought every woman should be barefoot and pregnant. And, Janet had a great idea. If she'd have walked in with a rug on over her head, you know, and barefoot, and said, anything else you want me to do, dear? I got anything else? You know, that would have really thrown him for a loop. But it's funny, during this answers and questions time with these people, whenever she wanted to change the conversation, she'd take her hand and put it on a black guy's leg. After about the third or fourth time of that, I looked at him and I said, you going to let her tell you what to do? Oh, that set him off. What do you mean? I said, every time she wants to change the conversation, she puts her hand on your leg and you just change just like that. I'm an old man. I said, don't look like it to me. And at that point, he said, well, can you think of anything good Martin Luther King did for us? I said, no, I can't think of anything. I thought of something later, though. He breathed out carbon dioxide that does help the plants. But that's about all I could do for him. For a Baptist preacher to openly mock Jesus Christ, I don't think very highly of him. And he was nothing but a puppet of the communists. Okay, and so that's... Now, color of his skin does not matter. Don't make an issue with me. Ted Kennedy is the same mold. Same mold. And it's a real blessing when you find an honest black person who tells you that my race is really dropping the ball. Who's that? Well, there's a conservative on the radio. Walt Williams? I think he's on once in a while. He's pretty decent. Alan Keyes is pretty decent. How about honoring somebody like George Washington Carver? Why do they pick a communist? Oh, well. Okay, mend your ways. He didn't back down, so don't back down. When people call names, don't back down from them. It's just it's because they've lost all argument. Name calling is because they've lost all argument. Okay, and, but there is a time where you do refer to that. Of course, the Lord shows us that. And that's mainly dealing with the upper echelon of people, the elite. The common man, very gentle, very slow with them. Verse 14, as for me, behold, I am in your hand. Do with me as seemeth good and meet with you. Now, isn't that a relaxed individual? Man, these people want to kill him. He said, oh, that's for me? Go ahead, do what you want. That's pretty laid back and or an extreme amount of faith in God. He says, but know ye for certain that if you put me to death, ye shall surely bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city and upon the inhabitants thereof. For of a truth, the Lord hath sent me unto you to speak all these words in your ears. Boy, he's pretty relaxed, isn't he? And when you have the truth, we can relax about these things. Obviously, he would have had a lot of experience. I mean, if you're getting thrown into something like this for the first time, you're going to be nervous, your heart's going to be beating, you're going to be scared to death. The telly gives a false impression of courage. People think that courage is an absence of fear. That's not courage. Courage is doing right in the presence of fear. Courage is doing what you know to be right when you're scared to death. That's what courage is. Don't tell me these brave soldiers just walk in there, you know, just relax, you know, blowing everybody away. They're scared to death. They're scared to death. But they're doing what they're told to do and being scared at the same time. If they're not scared, something's wrong up on top. I mean, bullets flying around and everything. Now, Paul put it in this fashion where he was being persecuted but not cast down. Fear on every side, he said. Okay, and so we're not going to get away from our human emotions when we are first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth time into an event. You know, the first time you go in a courtroom, it's a scary thing. It's intimidating. Second time, it's an intimidating thing. Third time's intimidating thing. Every time you go in there, it's intimidating until you kind of figure out the ropes, and that takes probably 100 times in there. So, it's just the way things are. When you're not used to these things, you're dealing with somebody. You ever call a radio program where they have a call-in thing? First couple times you do that, that's a scary thing. These people can hit the button anytime. They can manipulate your words any way they want. And so you got to deal with these things, with these people, and just do what the Lord leads you to do. You say, I'm scared. So am I. Just do what the Lord leads you to do. I'm scared to witness for Christ. We all are. Witness for the Lord Jesus. I heard about a guy, you know, he was so scared to go knocking on doors that he'd work himself up in a frenzy and he'd throw up. So what would he do? He'd throw up, then knock on the door. And that's how it is. The very first time I started knocking on doors, you know, I was scared to death. I went by myself. First person slammed the door in my face. I said, that's enough of that. I'm going home. And so we all have these fears. If the Lord can help me to get out and talk to people, he can help anybody. As far, you know, the shyness and being introvert and everything, I can easily become a hermit. No problem with me becoming a hermit. And that's my nature. It's funny, you go down to PBI and talk to Doc and Dr. Ruckman, he don't talk to very many people. You got to talk to him 10 minutes of the night, Brother Glenn? But I'm thinking, 10 minutes? How'd you get 10 minutes? Must have really pulled on his ear. I mean, he's hard to talk to. And that's his personality. But the Lord sure is using him in a wonderful way. Okay, verse 16. Then said the princes and all the people unto the priests and to the prophets, this man is not worthy to die. Well, praise the Lord for some honesty here. For he hath spoken to us in the name of the Lord our God. Then rose up certain of the elders of the land and spake to all the assembly of the people, saying, Micah the Moresh... A fight prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and spake to all the people of Judah, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Zion shall be plowed like a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house of the high places of a forest. Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, and all of Judah put him and all to death? That's a good way to handle something. Quote some history. Quote some scripture. Show what people did in the past. Did he not fear the Lord and besought the Lord, and the Lord repented him of the evil which he had pronounced against them? Thus might we procure the great evil against our souls? And there was also a man that prophesied in the name of the Lord, Uriah, the son of Shemaiah of Kirjath-Jearim, who prophesied against this city and against this land according to all the words of Jeremiah. And when Jehoiakim the king with all his mighty men and all the princes heard his words, the king sought to put him to death. But when Uriah heard it, he was afraid and fled and went into Egypt. And Jehoiakim the king sent men into Egypt, namely Elnathan, the son of Achbor, and certain men with him into Egypt, and they fetched him, Uriah, out of Egypt, and brought him unto Jehoiakim the king, who slew him with the sword, and cast his dead body into the graves of the common people. Nevertheless, the hand of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, was with Jeremiah, that they should not give him into the hand of the people to put him to death. Notice somebody intercedes for Jeremiah. The Lord, at the last instance, brought somebody in there to help Jeremiah. Now, did Jeremiah know that? Well, if Jeremiah was in the mood of chapter 20, he probably was hoping they were going to kill him to get out of this mess. You know, there are several men in the Bible that asked God to kill them. Moses did once. Elijah did once. Paul sure did act like he wanted to get killed. And after going to heaven, we'd probably all act the same way. Okay, chapter 27. Very unusual chapter 27. And if you kind of try to envision this, it's an interesting thing. In the beginning of the reign of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, came this word unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Thus saith the Lord to me, Make thee bonds and yokes and put them on thy neck. Okay, so it's got a visual illustration here. So he takes some time and builds these things, or if he goes down to the local bond and yoke factory and, you know, buys some down there. So what are you supposed to do to these things? And send them to the king of Edom, the king of Moab, the king of the Ammonites, the king of Tyrus, and the king of Zidon, by the hand of the messengers which came to Jerusalem unto Zedekiah, king of Judah. Okay, can you imagine this? Jeremiah, if he has a church, or if he has a meeting time with people, probably would not have more than 25 people show up for his meetings. Because one of the kings said to him, you and your small remnant. Now, as far as naming anybody that listened to him or tried to help them out, Ebed-Melech was one fella. And then later on, he had his kind of his secretary or the guy that Baruch always wrote the things out for him. But as far as naming any converts that listened to Jeremiah, there was really none named. And as far as the number of people, let's give him a little more than that. Let's say he's got 100 people that listen to him regularly in some sort of a meeting where they would get together. Let's say 100. You know, that can be considered a remnant in a big town. And so here's this guy, a pastor of less than 100 people or 100 people, and he's sending a message to the governor of Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. Yeah, right. Like they're going to listen to him. Well, that's what he's doing. That's what he's told to do. Okay, so he's got these other nations, and they're going to listen to this guy. Verse 4, And command them to say unto your masters, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Thus shall you say unto your masters. Okay, here's the message you're supposed to give these kings. From who? From Jeremiah. A guy that's got a very small band of people. An interesting thing, though, think about it. You're going to find truth is usually disseminated amongst the minority, the small group of people. And a lot of times, the geniuses or the people with the original ideas, if there are such a thing as original ideas, will have the smaller crowds that listen to them. You look at Gene's law class. What do we have? 20-some? 30? 20 to 30-some people? Last class we had was less than 20 people. Somebody walk in and say, well, what do you think you're doing? Well, how many did the Lord have meet with him regularly? 12? Boy, those 12 sure did something. 11. There was a in agriculture field several years ago, there was a man that taught on calcium my dad liked to listen to, Dr. Tegent. How many would he usually have in his? 15 to 20 people. The guy was a genius as far as getting the ground in the position where it can grow great crops. How many people would go listen to him? Not too many. Why is that? Well, it's the ones with the big money are the ones getting the big crowds. And when they go to these agriculture schools like at Purdue or whatnot, are they going to teach against the ones who are giving them the money? Obviously not. So a lot of times you're going to find that the books that are published by private individuals or small book companies are the ones where you're going to find the truth. The ones put out by the big book companies, and you're going to find in most cases any of the big churches, you ain't going to get much truth. I mean, the mega big churches, forget it as far as getting some truth disseminated. Why is that? That's just the law of life, it seems like. Of course, when you deal with the Catholic Church, people say, well, we can't be wrong, we have so many. Don't you think Noah heard that quite often before the flood? Yeah, I'm sure he heard that a lot. And the reason why the Lord does that, the reason why that happens is because when the few are doing something for God, then God gets the glory rather than the crowd. Not many mighty men, not many noble, not many wise men after the flesh are called, it says in 1 Corinthians. And so he says to the people that are wise in this world, 1 Corinthians 3, let him become a fool that he may be wise. And so the church where everybody is somebody is a church that isn't being used by God. The church where everybody's a nobody might see some action with God. You see, we know that God can create something out of nothing. And so if a man remains nothing, then God can do something with him. And people have Baptists have a hard time with this, where they talk about so-and-so being a great man. No, so-and-so was a little man who had a great God that happened to use him. And that's the way it should be. Okay, now here we go. Jeremiah is sending these notices out. Verse 6. And now have I given all these lands unto the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beast of the field have I given him also to serve him. And all nations shall serve him, and his son, and his son's son. Boy, he's sticking his neck out, isn't he? Detailed prophecy. His son's son, that'd be Belshazzar. Until the very time of his hand come, or let his land come, and then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. It shall come to pass that the nation, the kingdom which will not serve the same Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and that will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith the Lord, with the sword, and with the famine, and with the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. Therefore, hearken not ye to your prophets, nor your diviners, nor your dreamers, nor to your enchanters, nor to your sorcerers, which speak unto you, saying, you shall not serve the king of Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you to remove you far from the land, and that I should drive you out and you should perish, but the nation that bring their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him, those will I let remain still in their own land, saith the Lord, and they shall till it and dwell therein. I wonder how many of those guys listened. Okay, can you imagine again? Okay, I've sent out notices to the governor of Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, that God has ordered you five states to fall under the yoke of the governor of Kentuck. Yeah, right. If you yield to the governor of Kentucky, then you could stay in your land and live out for 70 years. He is going to rule his son and his son's son. And if you yield to that, then you could stay in your land. If you don't listen, you're going to get it. And they're going to say, who do you think you are? I'm a nobody. And then he says in that same letter, don't listen to your wise men, don't listen to your advisors, your dreamers. Isn't it interesting? These political figures had sorcerers consulting them. Do you remember when Nancy Reagan was broadcast to consult the stars to see if Ronald Reagan should fly in a certain plane at some time? And some people said, oh, I can't believe that. They all do that. Why? Because they have friends in high places, principalities, powers, rulers of the darkness of this world. Inaugural address. Isn't that interesting? Inaugural address. An augur, A-U-G-U-R, is somebody who divines by studying the parts of animals. And we have an inaugural address. They all check into these things because many of these people have spirit guides that are guiding them, because the devil is in charge of the kingdom of this world. It's amazing to me how people think that governing authorities, any governing authorities, have our best interests at heart. You run a slur down our county right now, we have Relay for Life. Help donate to solve, you know, get money to cure cancer. One of our men down there said to somebody, I think there's already a cure for cancer. And that person said, okay, Pastor Hoffman, to him. What are they implying? There is a cure for cancer already, but the American Cancer Society don't want you and I to know it because they would lose too much money. You say, are they that evil? Yes. The love of money is the root of all evil. There's a great book to read, Rogers Rhodes, A Recovery from AIDS. It's a medical doctor in California. He got AIDS. He was a medical doctor in San Francisco. He contracted AIDS and he got the advanced stage of carpal tunnel. Is that what it is? No, this is some cancerous thing in his feet. Dean, you know what that means? Some advanced cancer in his feet. Something like that. I don't know. But he was given very short time to live, and so he went to another medical doctor, said, you're going to cure me. And then a third medical doctor got involved, and somehow they came across the idea of juice fasting. And soaking in a bathtub and things like that, and he juice fasts for 40 days, and after 40 days, he's cured of everything. 40 days. And he thought they'd be happy for him. And it's an interesting book to read. And he started traveling and telling them about the great joy, the great health thing that he had, and they told him to shut up. They said, get out of here. And you would think that Christian colleges would be excited that you don't have to study the Greek lexicons anymore. You could study sixth grade English in a King James Bible. You go there and show them that great revelation and they tell you to shut up. And of course the same thing goes in the courtrooms all over the place. Okay, so this is the power of God. Now after this prophecy came true to the head, don't you think those kings had a different opinion of Jeremiah? Yeah, they did. Verse 12. He says, I spake also to Zedekiah, king of Judah, according to all these words, saying, bring your necks under the yoke of the king of Babylon, serve him and his people, live. Why will you die? It's a shame. Why will you die? People, for some reason, are on the road to destruction and they just don't mind dying. Curtis Hudson got cancer. Curtis Hudson changed to the Hallelujah Diet. Was given a clean bill of health after about a year. Went back to his original diet and that cancer came back on him like gangbusters. 2 months before he died, he told his children, he said, that Hallelujah Diet works. Dies 2 months later. It's an amazing thing. It's a diet that George Malkmus teaches. It's got North Carolina. I can give you some information. It's 85% raw fruit and vegetables, 15% cooked. It's a very strict diet. But that's what he went on, and he was given a clean bill of health. And interesting story. I would have thought. Especially when you have the evidence of it. Mr. Taylor's neighbor. Yep. No. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's how they are. He's, look at Jeremiah. He says, why are you going to die? Why are you going to die? I don't know. Verse 13, why will you die, thou and thy people, by the sword, by the famine, by the pestilence? As the Lord has spoken against the nation that will not serve the king of Babylon. Therefore, hearken not unto the words of the prophets that speak unto you, saying, ye shall not serve the king of Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. For I have not sent them, saith the Lord, yet they prophesy a lie in my name, that I might drive you out, and that you might perish, ye and the prophets that prophesy unto you. Also I spake to the priests and to all the people, saying, thus saith the Lord, hearken not to the words of your prophets that prophesy unto you, saying, behold, the vessels of the Lord's house shall now shortly be brought again from Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. Okay, this would be after 606. Babylon comes in and conquers and attacks them like three different times. And the first time they took 606, they took all the rich boys and all the rich that they wanted, and then they took their wealth out of the temple. That's when they took Daniel, took them back to Babylon. Then in 598, they came a second time and they took all the middle class that they wanted, took them back. That's when they took Ezekiel. And in 586, that's when they came and actually just wiped the place out and left all the poor folks there. Now that's what the world will do to you and I. They'll do all they can to get what they can out of us, and once you don't have anything, they'll dump you. Well, that's what's different about the Lord. He preaches the gospel of peace unto the poor. That's usually when the Lord steps in, when man becomes desperate enough, and the Lord steps in and says, hey, I got something better for you. But it's too bad that we have to wait till we become desperate enough. Okay, verse 16. He says, also I spake to the priests, to all the people, saying, thus saith the Lord, hearken not to the words of your prophets that prophesy unto you. Oh, I read that. 17. Hearken not unto them. Verse 17. Hearken not unto them, serve the king of Babylon, and live. Wherefore should this city be laid waste? But they be prophets, and if the word of the Lord be with them, let them now make intercession to the Lord of hosts, that the vessels which are left in the house of the Lord and the house of the king of Judah and at Jerusalem go not to Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts concerning the pillars and concerning the sea. That's the sea is the also known as the laver. When you walk into the temple, you have the first thing you see is the burnt sacrifice. And then you walk behind that is a round, huge, very round, huge basin thing where they would wash their hands. It would have like a looking glass like in a bottom, so you can see your reflection in the water. Okay, so that's the sea that it's talking about. And concerning the bases and concerning the residue of the vessels that remained in the city, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took not, when he carried away captive Zechaniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from Jerusalem to Babylon, and all the nobles of Judah and Jerusalem. That'd be 606 B.C. when he did that. So he's reverting back some history. Yea, thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning the vessels that remain in the house of the Lord and in the house of the king of Judah and of Jerusalem. They shall be carried to Babylon, and there shall they be until the day that I visit them, saith the Lord. Then will I bring them up and restore them to this place. And that'd be 70 years later. Okay, that's 27. Any questions or comments? Are we covered? No questions, no comments. Nadine.